Mr. Habeck's body was discovered by News Tribune employee Pilar O'Brien while she was reporting to work. Police Lieutenant Francisco Gomez stated Mr. Habeck had been shot once in the head at apparently close range by a handgun of as yet undetermined caliber. The gun was not discovered at the scene of the crime. It was not a gangland slaying. A graduate of the state system of education and for years a visiting lecturer at the law school, Habeck, blah, blah, blah. The report goes on to recount his most famous cases. Barbara turned to an inside page. At great length. Want me to read all that? I went through all that yesterday. Even I know how to write obituaries. I think son-in-law Tom Farley should be arrested, charged, convicted, and imprisoned immediately. Barbara refolded the newspaper. You think Tom Farley murdered Habeck? Tom Farley wrote that poem you read me last night. Isn't that enough reason to imprison him? A man who writes a so-called poem like that shouldn't be left loose to walk around in the streets. It was not a gangland slaying. Am I supposed to ask you why you keep saying that? Are you asking? I suppose so. In order to drive into the parking lot of the News Tribune, you have to stop and identify yourself and state your purpose to the guard at the gate. But anyone can walk in and out. Habeck's car was parked more toward the back of the lot than the front. I just can't see professional gangsters stopping and saying anything to the guard at the gate, driving in, doing their dirty deed, then driving out again. I also can't see a professional gangster parking his car outside the gate, walking in, popping Habeck in the head, and then walking out. Can you? A professional gangster would have hit Habeck somewhere else. Strange no one heard the shot. A small caliber handgun makes a pop so slight, especially in a big open-air parking lot, you could mistake the sound for a belch after eating Greek salad. Barbara stretched out beside him on the bed. Guess I should start the long drive back to the city, Fletch said. You don't have to go yet. How do you know? There are many, many things I want to do today, and some I don't. Don't forget you're having dinner with Mother and me tonight to discuss the wedding. Fletch glanced at his watch. Well, we really did wake up awfully early. I guess we have time. I know. Barbara cupped her hands behind his neck. That's because I took down all the window curtains in here last night, before you arrived. Chapter 18. Good morning, Fletch said cheerily to the middle-aged woman in an apron who opened the door to him at 12339 Palmyra Drive, The Heights. Her eyes narrowed as she recognized him as the man who had run through her kitchen the day before, wearing nothing but a denim shirt hanging from his waist. He gave her a big smile. I'm really not all the trouble I'm worth. Yes? She asked. I just want to deliver this package. He handed the grocery bag filled with Donald Habeck's clothes through the doorway to her. I'd also like to see Mrs. Habeck, if possible. The woman kept the door braced with her feet when she took the package with both hands. The string had loosened. In seclusion, she said, under sedation. One of Donald Habeck's black shoes dropped out of the bag. Oh, my, Fletch said. He picked up the shoe and put it on top of the bundle in her arms. The woman drew her head back from the shoe. One other question, Fletch went on. There was an older woman here yesterday sitting by the pool. Bluish hair, red purse, green sneakers. Do you know who she was? The woman looked at Fletch through narrow slits over Donald Habeck's shoe. She said she was Mrs. Habeck. She acted strangely. I do not speak English, the woman said. Not a single goddamned word. I see. She closed the door. I'll be back to see Mrs. Habeck when she's feeling better, Fletch shouted through the door. Getting into his car in the driveway, Fletch looked up at the house. A window curtain in the second story fell back into place. Chapter 19. Thank you for seeing me, Fletch said slowly, so promptly. He was surprised the curator of contemporary art at the museum was seeing him at all, let alone at 9:30 in the morning without an appointment. He expected museum curators to keep relaxed hours. He also expected any museum curator to be standoffish with someone presenting himself in blue jeans and t-shirt, however fresh and clean, sneakers, however new and glistening white, who said he was from a newspaper. He also did not expect any museum curator, however contemporary, to be sitting behind a desk in a Detroit Tigers baseball cap. On the desk, beside one huge book with Margoleth written in script on the glossy cover, and a few folders, was an outfielder's mitt and a baseball. "You're from the News Tribune," curator William Kennedy confirmed. "Yes, I was assigned to report on the $5 million gift to the museum that was to be announced by Donald and Jasmine Habeck." Fletch smiled slightly at his accurate use of the past tense. "A lady in your trustee's office said she thought the gift was to be made to this department."
"I'm glad to talk to someone, anyone, about it," Kennedy said.
Fletch asked, "Are you from Detroit?"
"No."
Kennedy took off his baseball cap and looked at its logo. "I just admire excellence in any form."
"I see.
I also collect video cassettes of Nureyev, Muhammad Ali, and Michael Jackson, recordings of Caruso, McCormick, Errol Garner, and Eric Clapton. Do you think I'm odd?"
Eclectic.
"I'm a perfectly happy man." Kennedy reached for his baseball mitt. "I don't know why everyone isn't like me."
"Neither do I," Fletch said.
"Do you collect things?"
"Yes," Fletch said, "people."
"What an interesting thought."
"I don't use people, just collect them. It gives me some interesting memories on the long drive."
"Is that why you're a journalist?"
"I suppose so, that and a few other reasons."
"You have less of a storage problem than I have."
"First, I need to confirm with you that Mr. and Mrs. Donald Habeck were giving this department of the museum $5 million.
"I'm not sure."
Kennedy tossed the ball up into the air and caught it in his mitt.
"And if they were going to actually make such an offer in writing, I'm not sure we would accept it."
Fletch raised his eyebrows.
"Wouldn't a museum accept money from any source?"
"Oh, the source doesn't bother us. In my 15-year museum career to date, I've never seen money turned down because of its source, even if it were tainted money. Remember that old wheeze about Mark Twain? A minister came to him saying that a gangster had offered him money to fix the church's roof. Twain asked, 'Why are you hesitating?' The minister said, 'Because it's tainted money.' 'That's right,' Twain said. 'Tain't yours and tain't mine.'"
"You collect good stories, too?"
"As they come along."
"I think I'm hearing you saying that you considered Habeck's money tainted."
Kennedy shrugged.
"We know he was a tricky lawyer."
"By tricky, do you mean crooked? I think I'm collecting polite ways of saying crooked."
"How often do you hear of lawyers going to jail?"
"Not often. Doctors get sick, but lawyers seldom go to jail."
"Why would a museum turn down money?"
"Because of the stipulations that come with the money. Let me explain."
Kennedy put his mitted hand on top of the baseball cap on his head. His other hand spun the baseball on the desk. "Late last week, Donald Habeck made an appointment to see me. I was dismayed when my secretary told me that she had made the appointment. We had never pursued Donald Habeck. I've never heard that he cared anything about art or the museum. Therefore, I suspected he wanted to talk to me about being an expert witness for a case of his, something of that sort."
"And you wouldn't have agreed?"
"I don't think so. I have been an expert witness in court, of course, but only when I have felt that I was on solid ground, could trust whichever side of a case requested me. I don't make a career of it. Only when I feel need for me is justified."
"And you didn't feel you could trust Donald Habeck?"
"I didn't know anything about him other than an impression of him that has come through the newspapers and television press. Vaguely, my impression was that through a lot of tricks he kept people who ought to be in jail out of it. I'd never met the man."
Fletch noted how quick people were to say they had never met or had scarcely met Donald Habeck.
"So Habeck was given an appointment, but not invited to lunch," Kennedy continued. "He came in last Wednesday afternoon, sat in the chair you're sitting in, and surprised the hell out of me by saying he was thinking of giving the museum $5 million.
"What was your first question?"
Kennedy thought a moment. "My first question was, 'Of your own money?' Immediately, I was suspicious of I don't know what."
"And he confirmed it was his own money he wanted to give away?"
"Yes. I then said, as politely as I could, that I had never heard he was interested either in art or the museum. He answered that he was very interested in art, and furthermore, that he had identified what he referred to as a vast hole in our present contemporary collection."
"That got your attention?"
"It certainly did. I could hardly wait to hear what hole he felt was in our collection.
Ours is not the strongest collection of contemporary art in the whole world, but it is very strong and really quite well balanced, thanks to my predecessor and myself. Kennedy was again playing catch with himself. He said he wanted the $5 million spent exclusively on acquiring contemporary religious art. After a moment, Fletch said, "That's a puzzle."
"Isn't it?"
Looking at Fletch apologetically, Kennedy said,
"As you know or don't know, there is almost no contemporary religious art. I mean, all art is religious, isn't it? In its own way, even the profane. Art depicts man in his relation to nature, himself, his fellow persons, and his deity. Not all of it may be worshipful, but each piece of true art, to me, is a powerful acknowledgement of the nature of our existence."
How did you answer him?
Politely, I asked him whom he thought we should be collecting. In true legalistic fashion, he answered that we are supposed to be the experts in that, and that if we felt we couldn't find viable contemporary religious art to acquire, he'd take his money elsewhere.
A tough guy, even in his giving. Wait, you haven't heard everything.
Gently, I tried to explain to Mr. Habeck that if there were much viable contemporary religious art, I'd be the first to seek it out and acquire it. Of course, prayer card art, like the poor, is ever with us. Some churches have developed very contemporary-looking designs for their crosses and stations thereof. But unless you consider a Jesus with female breasts on the cross a viable statement, there isn't much new in the field. As critics and curators, we find ourselves nowadays, perhaps mistakenly, considering the various religious genres, from creation to Joan at the stake, closed history.
Kennedy tossed the ball high and caught it.
Then I realized I was lecturing the poor man, and that was not why he came here. I could see he was getting angry. I was on the wrong track altogether. So, more personally, I asked him why he wanted to contribute so much money.
A question we all have.
I expect the answer will astound you. After a few moments of writhing in that chair, I'm sure looking as uncomfortable as any witness under his own cross-examination, Habeck blurted out that his life was over, that he was packing it in. No one cared a tin whistle for him. He was dispossessing himself of all his property, and...
Kennedy threw the ball high in the air. He had to lean forward to catch it. He intended to spend the rest of his life in a Roman Catholic monastery. After a moment of silence, Kennedy threw the ball across the desk at Fletch. Catching the ball, Fletch said, "Glunk."
"Thought that would surprise you," Kennedy said. "You see why I'm happy to talk to you this morning. A very strange circumstance indeed."
"My, my, who'd have thought it?"
"Aren't people amazing? Well worth your collecting."
"He wanted to become a monk?"
"Yes, so he said. A Roman Catholic monk. Spend the rest of his life reading Thomas Merton or something. Matins and Evensong, the whole bit."
"He always wore black shoes."
"What?"
"Never mind."
"Needless to say, we've had some staff meetings around here to discuss this whole Habeck business. No one has known what to think. Then yesterday, when I was driving out to lunch, I heard on the car radio Habeck had been murdered. When he said last Wednesday that his life was over, he was more right than he knew."
"If he wanted to give away $5 million and go into the monastery, why didn't he give the money to the monastery or to the church?"
"I asked him that. He said he was too old ever to fulfill a ministry. Furthermore, that he would have too much to learn. And he wanted the peace and quiet of a monastery. He said he was tired of talking and arguing and pleading. Would you believe that?"
"So, establishing a collection of religious art at the museum would do his public pleading for him?"
"I guess."
"He hoped such a collection would inspire religious feelings among contemporary people more than any sermons he could ever give or ever want to give, if I understood him correctly."
Fletch tossed the ball back to Kennedy in a high arc.
"I don't get it."
"He said he'd have something more than $1 million left over, and that money he would give to the monastery."
"What about his wife, his kids, his grandchildren?"
"He didn't mention them, except to say no one cared a tin whistle for him. His words exactly."
Kennedy tossed the baseball back to Fletch. "A museum as church, huh?"
"A museum is partly a church, maybe entirely a church."
"So how did you leave it with him?"
"I was so startled I suggested he think it over. I think I even dared suggest he talk it over with his wife, his children, and his law partners." Fletch tossed the ball back in as high an arc as the room could take.
Curator as minister, huh?
Or shrink. And I told him we'd talk it over here. I indicated very strongly to him that I didn't feel we could take his $5 million with the restriction that it be spent solely on acquiring contemporary religious art. It wouldn't be fair to him to accept money on conditions we couldn't observe. He tossed the ball back to Fletch.
If he could find some wording which would make the money available to us to use, with the understanding that we would acquire valid contemporary religious art when and if it became available, then maybe we could accept his money.
Fletch arced the ball back at the curator. And he, being a lawyer, was perfectly sure that he could develop such wording.
Probably. The story of his murder I read on the front page of your newspaper this morning said he intended to see your publisher regarding the announcement that he was giving $5 million to something in the city.
The museum was what was mentioned to me.
Did you write that piece in this morning's paper?
No, Biff Wilson.
Kennedy tossed the ball into his glove.
It was a good piece.
It was okay, Fletch said, for an obituary.
Chapter 20. In the very small reception room of the Ben Franklin Friends Service, the young, middle-aged, distinguished-looking woman gave Fletch the once-over from behind her small wooden desk.
If you take your left here at the corner, she said, pointing a manicured hand, and left again in the middle of the block, you'll find yourself in the alley.
Ecstatic.
Our delivery door's about halfway down on the left.
Over her pink sweatsuit, she wore a long rope of pearls.
The door is clearly marked.
Pure ecstasy.
The woman frowned.
You are making a delivery, aren't you?
She looked more the type to be sitting at a checkout desk in a public library.
What am I delivering? Fletch asked.
Linen, towels.
Me.
You?
Me. And all my parts. Head, shoulders, hips, and knee joints right down to the ankles, and everything in between.
Fletch swallowed hard.
Do you have an appointment?
She opened a desk calendar.
You're just not the sort...
Sort of what?
Her eyes confirmed that he was wearing a T-shirt, faded jeans, and very white new sneakers.
The sort we usually see.
I was welcomed by the museum dressed this way.
Your name?
Jaffe.
Ah, yes, Fletcher Jaffe.
She made a pencil mark in the inbox beside his name.
You've heard that name before?
We don't pay much attention to names.
Jaffe is a name to which you should pay attention.
That will be $150.
Good, I'll pay it.
He dropped 7 20s and a 10 on the desk.
Make sure I get a receipt.
She looked quizzically at him.
Our clients don't usually ask for receipts.
I do.
I'll make out a receipt for you before you leave.
Why not now?
Well, you might want to add some extras.
Extra what? The woman seemed embarrassed.
Tips, whatever.
I see.
You're not married, are you?
Fletch shook his head. No, ma'am. No one goes through my pockets.
Diseases?
Her eyes enlarged as she looked at him.
Are you willing to swear you have no diseases?
This place is harder to get into than a New England prep school. I asked you about diseases.
Chickenpox.
Chickenpox? When I was 9.
Fletch pointed out a pockmark on his left elbow.
I'm better now, thank you.
The woman sighed. She pressed a button on the desk intercom.
Cindy, someone's here to see you.
Ah, Cindy, exclaimed Fletch. I was hoping for a Cindy. Nobody wants a Zsa Zsa, Queenie, or Bobo this hour of the day.
I've seen you somewhere before, the woman said, almost to herself.
Recently.
I'm around town, Fletch said breezily. A bit of a boulevardier.
Oh, Cindy, said the woman, this is Fletcher Jaffe. In the door stood a woman in her early 20s. She was dressed only in well-cut nylon gym shorts, sneakers, and footies. Her shoulders were lightly muscled. Her perk breasts were tanned and the round identically with the rest of her body. Muscles were visible on her stomach. Her black hair and wide-set eyes matched perfectly and had the same sparkle.
Looking at Fletch, she wrinkled her nose.
Good morning, Cindy.
Fletch again swallowed hard.
Glad you came to work early today.
Through the street door came another young woman. She was wearing white jeans and a loose red shirt. She had flyaway blonde hair. Approaching the desk, she openly studied the scene. Fletch standing in the middle of the small reception room, Cindy presenting herself in the doorway.
"Marta," she whimpered to the woman at the desk.
"I can't help it, Carla," Marta answered.
"You told me I should sleep in this morning."
"I also told you," Marta said forcefully, "never to wear that color red. It doesn't go with your hair coloring."
"I know," Carla giggled. "It makes men in the street look away."
In the interior doorway, Cindy tossed her head. Fletch followed her. He followed her down a paneled, carpeted corridor.
"You a cop?" she asked.
"No." "I hope you are," Cindy muttered. "Time this place got busted." She slowed her walk.
"Do me a favor, though, will you?"
"Anything."
"Bust this place if you want. See where it'll get you. But don't bust me personally, okay?"
"What makes you think I'm a cop?"
"I'm splitting the end of this week. I swear to you, I don't want the hassle."
"If I'm a cop, you're ugly." Even in the dark corridor, her skin had a lovely sheen. She smiled at the compliment. She opened a heavy drawer built into the wall and pulled out another pair of well-cut nylon shorts.
"These about right, waist 30?
She tossed them to him.
"Sure."
She led him into a brightly lit room to the left of the corridor. In the room was a single-frame exercise rig. The walls were covered with mirrors. Mirrors hung from the ceiling. At one place there was even a mirror on the floor, inset into the carpet. Fletch stood on the floor mirror and looked up and around. Through the angled ceiling mirrors he saw himself from directions he had never seen himself before. In the mirrors on the four walls he saw his body replicated to infinity. Cindy closed the door to the corridor.
"Where'd you get your tan?"
"On my face."
"Anywhere else?"
She crossed the room, went through a door to a bathroom, came back immediately and tossed him a towel. Standing on the mirror, looking around at himself everywhere, Fletch said, "Me, me, me."
"You got it, honey."
He held the towel and shorts in his hand.
"Take a shower," she said. "Use the soap. Change into just the shorts and come back."
Fletch held the shorts up.
"These shorts ain't got nothing in them."
"They will have," she said, "I expect." The shower soap stung. When he re-entered the room, Cindy was at a small recessed bar mixing a drink. She glanced at him.
"I thought so."
"You thought what?" She was bringing him the drink.
"What vitamins do you take?"
"P."
"Never heard of it."
"All the best beers have it." She handed him the drink. Her other hand dropped 5 stuffed olives into his hand. He sniffed the drink.
"What's in it?" "Orange juice."
"Okay." He munched the olives.
"Some protein powder."
"That sounds healthy."
"A little yeast."
"Sounds explosive."
"And some ground elk's horn."
"I was hoping you'd say that."
"An aphrodisiac, you know."
"Anything else?"
"No."
"Specialty of the house?"
"Drink it, honey. Perfectly safe."
He sipped it. "Yummy."
"Chug-a-lug," she said.
"Really?" he said, choking a little. "You thought of marketing this stuff?" Even while drinking it, his throat felt dusty. "Elixir of Ben Franklin."
"Come on."
She took the empty glass from him and put it on the recessed bar. Then she took his hand and led him to the exercise machine.
"You know how to use these things?"
"Of course you do.
Lie down on your back. You're going to do bench presses. I have it set for 120 pounds. That about right?"
"We'll see." He lay down on his back on the bench. His knees were bent, his feet on the floor. Looking up, he saw himself on the top of Cindy's head and her shoulders in the mirror.
"Lift," she said.
He lifted.
"That's about right," she said. "Feel good?"
"Like ice cream on a hot summer's day."
"Do 8 in a row, slowly."
She sat on him, straddling his thighs. She spread her hands on his lower stomach, thumbs touching. As he lifted, she pressed her hands into his stomach muscles. He felt a sensation such as he had never felt before. He groaned.
"Don't drop it," she said. "Makes a loud noise."
He let the weights down quietly and looked into her eyes.
"Come on," she said. "You're going to do 8 of them in a row. I'm giving you every motive. Breathe."
He breathed and lifted. On the third lift, he found his legs straightening, his heels sliding along the rug. She did not fall off his thighs. Through the mirror, he saw that she had hooked the calves of her legs around the legs of the bench. At each lift, she pressed the palms of her hands into his stomach muscles. "Breathe," she said.
"That too?"
After he did 8 lifts, she flicked the front of his shorts with her fingernails. "You're healthy enough, I thought so." He raised his knees. "I'll take your sweat," she said. She leaned forward and put her breasts, her stomach, on his. She raised her legs and put her thighs on his. She rolled on him just a little. As soon as he gave in to an irresistible impulse and put his arms around her back, she was up and away. She stood under the chin-up grips. "Come on."
"Who said exercise has to be boring?"
As they moved in the brightly lit room, their infinite reflections in the mirrors on all sides made it seem as if each were a legion moving with martial precision. "Put your hands on the back of the grips." Standing on his toes, he stretched totally and put his hands around the grips. "No," she said, "put your hands further back on the grips." He did so. "Now do a chin-up." He did so while she watched. "Again," she said. While he was lifting himself a second time, Cindy jumped up and grabbed the grips just in front of his hands. Her body knocked against his. She lifted herself with him, their bodies just brushing. She stared into his eyes as they lifted themselves slowly, together, lowered themselves to full stretch, up again. "Now, stay up," Cindy said.
"As if I had a choice."
She wrapped her legs around his hips. Slowly, she relaxed her hands on the grips. His body took her weight. She wrapped her arms around his neck. "Now, let us down slowly." She opened her mouth and put her teeth hard against his taut neck muscles. As he lowered them, every muscle, ligament, tissue, and piece of skin in his body above his waist was stretched to its maximum. There was a delirious crackling up his spine, a small explosion in the back of his head. As his feet settled on the floor, his knees buckled. Tangled, they both fell on the mat. Cindy laughed. "Not everybody can do that." Their legs were tangled. He put his arms around her. His shoulder muscles felt inflamed, inflated. She kissed his neck where she had bitten him. "I'm lapping up blood," she giggled.
"Gym class was never like this."
"You went to the wrong school."
"I always suspected that."
"We've got lots to do yet," she said.
"Will I be up for it?"
"I'll see to that." Cindy had not yet untangled herself from him when the door to the corridor opened. She jumped. She looked up at the doorway in genuine surprise. Chapter 21. "What's your game?" Marta asked Fletch from across her desk in the executive office of the Ben Franklin Friends Service.
"Game?"
Sitting in a small wooden captain's chair in front of the desk, Fletch looked down. He was still breathing somewhat heavily, still sweating, and the front of his flimsy yellow shorts indicated to any observer that his attention was still elsewhere.
"Warden, I'm suffering."
Marta picked up the phone on her desk and pushed 3 buttons. Into the phone she said, "Cindy, get dressed, then come in here."
"Take pity on me," Fletch said.
Reluctantly, he had followed Marta down the dark carpeted corridor to the office behind the reception room.